Next, I want to discuss briefly what is wrong with Karen Armstrong's basic thesis about myth and its role, as put forward in her book, A Short History of Myth, in particular in chapter 1, What is a Myth? She writes, "Mythology is not an early attempt at history and does not claim that its tales are objective facts. The Neanderthals who prepared their dead companion for a new life were perhaps engaged in the same game of spiritual make-believe that is common to all myth-makers. Quote, what if this world were not all that there is? How would this affect our lives, psychologically, practically, or socially? Would we become different, more complete? And if we did find that we were so transformed, would that not show that our mythical belief was true in some way? That it was telling us something important about our humanity, even though we could not prove this rationally?" And she goes on, "A myth, therefore, is true because it is effective, not because it gives us factual information. If, however, it does not give us new insight into the deeper meaning of life, it has failed. If it works, that is, if it forces us to change our minds and hearts, gives us new hope, and compels us to live more fully, it is a valid myth." Now, I'm tired, so I'm going to start with one word. Bullshit. But let's go on and discuss this a little bit more fully. Once again, we get back to the question of the difference, the qualitative difference between art, including myth, and reality, and between art and science. At the end of preaching from a pulpit of bones, I spoke to this point and made the point that both art and religion, as general characteristics and as distinguished from science, do not ask us to believe as a general phenomenon with regard to art. Art does not ask us to believe that what it presents is actually and literally true. What it has in common with religion is that it presents things about life which are not representations or mere reproductions of life as it is. How it differs from religion is not in that, because religion also presents things which are different than the way life actually is and reality actually is. Where the difference lies is that religion asks us to believe that what it presents is actually true, and not only true, but the defining and essential truth about reality and its motive causes and forces. To go into another dimension of this, we could discuss what is in common but also what is different between beauty and truth. Both, we could say, and I have said elsewhere, are important in their own right. And we could go on further and say that there is an aspect of beauty in truth, or in the discovery of truth. Beauty or art may reveal important truths, often from new angles. But beauty, or conceptions of beauty, and what is and is not beautiful, are unlike truth, socially conditioned, and have social content, and in overall sense correspond to and are part of one world outlook or another. Different classes, to put it in a certain way without being reductionist, have different views of what's beautiful and not beautiful. There is not a scientific way to arrive at what is beautiful and what is not. There is, by contrast, a scientific way to arrive at determining what is true and what is not true. Truths are important for changing the world, but not, again, in a narrow utilitarian sense. They are important in and of themselves in the sense that it is important to know what is true and what is not true, regardless of whether that has any immediate application in any particular sphere at a given time. And specifically, speaking of the objectives of communists, whether it relates directly to our political objectives. But nonetheless, truth is not socially conditioned and does not have social content. Or to put it another way, and simply, truth does not have a class character. As I've emphasized, any truth will enter so long as there are classes in one way or another in the overall process of things. It will enter into the class struggle. But it is not reducible to, nor is it determined, or can it be determined, by how it relates to the class struggle. Truth is objective. Truth is a correct, or more or less correct, approximation of objective reality, and doesn't depend on the class of person or persons who discover that truth, nor does it depend on the social impact of that truth as to whether or not it's actually true. So these are important points to recognize, and this is obviously completely opposed to what Armstrong's putting forward here about truth epistemologically, specifically in relation to myth. And one of the things that we see, besides other aspects of what's wrong with her viewpoint, and specifically the basic falsity of her essential assertion, her historically false claim that the myths of religion do not present themselves as though they are to be taken as truth in a factual or historical sense. They certainly do and certainly have. What is the battle over evolution all about? Evolution cannot be true because the Bible says that God created the heaven, the earth, and everything therein in 6 days, and on the seventh day he rested. That's presented as historical fact. That's not presented as a myth, which means it's art that you're supposed to take as some sort of organizing experience that doesn't really correspond to what literally happened in history and in fact. Quite the contrary. And throughout history, religious myths have been presented as truth and historical fact and fought for as such. Now, that's not to say there is never the presentation of a myth that's not said to be literally true. But to make a general statement that myths, and particularly in the context of religion, are not intended to be taken as true is completely false. But it's also, what she presents, is an expression of pragmatism and instrumentalism, as shown in her concept of what makes myth valid. This is another expression of what Lenin called the approach of truth as an organizing principle. Or another way of more crudely saying it is, if it's useful and helps achieve an objective, then it's true. And that is the definition of truth. And this is actually what she's arguing for. A myth is true because it is effective, not because it gives us factual information. So this is arguing for a different definition of truth, epistemologically, at least as applied to myths. It depends on whether or not it gives us new insight into the deeper meaning of life, which, by the way, we should say is a tautology. What's the deeper meaning of life? Except as defined by the same a priori notions with which she's approaching this. Who's to say what's the deeper meaning of life divorced from correspondence to reality? Apart from, and in a real sense, in opposition to its relationship to reality. If it works, here's the pragmatic definition and instrumentalist definition. If it works, then it's valid, and that's truth for a myth. Is it almost expressly what Lenin criticizes the approach of truth as an organizing principle? If it forces us to change our minds and hearts, gives us new hope, and compels us to live more fully, it is a valid myth. Power is the ability to define phenomena and cause them to act in the desired manner. It's the same idealist epistemology. And what it's arguing for is that it doesn't matter if something's factually true or not. It can be an illusion with regard to reality, but if it fulfills a function as defined by someone somewhere, a priori, then that's as good as, if not literally, the truth. And we know where that kind of thing can lead and has led and does lead. Not only to all kinds of errors, but also to all kinds of horrors. If everyone is free to choose what's valid and true according to whether it suits them, we're back to all the problems with relativism and all the attendant things that we've discussed in relation to that, including ultimately, particularly when myths conflict with each other, the reduction of things to a battle of power relations to see which myth can be imposed over the other. And there's no criterion, objective criterion of truth to distinguish any of this. Now this leads me to the question of certitude. Scientific and moral certitude, and what's the same and what's different about them. In science, and through the application of science, I should say, we can arrive at certitude, to invoke what perhaps is an oxymoron, a contradiction in terms, we can arrive at certitude relatively. Relative in the sense that reality is constantly changing and our best approximations of it are taking place in that context, and relative in the sense that whatever part of reality we understand is interconnected with other parts of reality, and as well as with all the changingness of reality. But nonetheless, while relative, it's real. This certitude is real. You can be certain about certain things. Evolution, we can be certain about. It stood the test of not just time in the abstract, but of repeated attempts to disprove it on the one hand, and it has been reinforced rather than undermined by the further continuing accumulation of evidence and the leap from evidence to synthesis, further knowledge. So we can say with certitude, evolution is a scientifically established fact, or in simple terms, it is true. And we can say with certitude, what the account of creation in Genesis is not true. Now, when you get to the question of morals, it's more complex. Arriving at the truth through scientific means is complex, but this is complex in a different way. Science, to put it a certain way, deals with what is, and perhaps also what is becoming and what has been. But science by itself cannot answer all the questions of, if you want to put it that way, ought. It can tell us what is, but it cannot by itself answer the question of what ought to be. This is something that came up, for example, in the conversation book, these general questions of the relation between beauty and truth and justice, and also the role of science in connection with the role of ethics and morals. Now, does that mean, therefore, that we can't have any moral certitude? No, we can have moral certitude relatively. We can scientifically determine what the communist revolution aims for and will achieve, and the changes that will bring about in human society, human relations, and the thinking of people. We can scientifically establish that with certitude. And we can say that the advance to communism represents an emancipation, the bringing into being of a better world for the great majority of people and ultimately for humanity. And we can say, therefore, that in making this leap, we are acting in a correspondence with the interests of the great majority of humanity and ultimately humanity as a whole. So we can say from that standpoint, we can have a moral certitude based on the understanding the advance to communism is in the interest of the great majority of humanity. Of course, people representing the bourgeoisie can say that ought not to happen, and they will argue that it's not good for humanity. And here, let's sort that out. Is the argument that it's not good for humanity merely a relative argument and there's no objective determination of that? No, we can't objectively determine that. However, to make the leap to say it ought to happen requires something beyond merely science. It does require a partisan standpoint and involve a partisan standpoint. But all this is related to points I've discussed previously about communist universalism, both in the scientific sense and in the sense that we can say that communism embraces not only various spheres of knowledge and endeavor of human beings, while not replacing them, but also it embraces the interests of the great majority of humanity. About that, we can have moral certitude. And therefore, from that standpoint, we argue this ought to be done and needs to be done. And this relates to the discussion in another talk of the whole question of why the communism as a world outlook and method is both objective and partisan. It both is a thoroughly, systematically, and comprehensively scientific method and outlook for engaging reality and understanding reality. And it corresponds, in the largest sense, to the interests of a class in leading the struggle to transform all of society, achieve the four alls, and bring forth the era of communism all over the world. And here is where the statement enters in, and the importance enters in of the statement that whatever is true is good for the proletariat, and that all truths will help us get to communism, if that's understood correctly. And this leads me to the next point I want to discuss before moving to a conclusion. And that's in terms of the relation between, or the contrast between, science and religion. The question which either explicitly or in many ways indirectly is posed, especially in today's world, has reason failed us? To begin to get into this, we can say that the truth will not set you free in and of itself, but we will not get free without the truth. And this ties in and is directly bound up with the statement that all truths are good for the proletariat, and everything that is actually true will help us get to communism. Reasoning And science and the results of science can, in certain aspects and certain dimensions, be used not only by the proletariat, but also by the bourgeoisie and other reactionaries and their conscious representatives. They can be used for very different purposes and be employed to promote radically different ends and objectives. But there is a profound difference between the thoroughly, systematically, consistently, all around and comprehensively scientific worldview and method of communism and opposing worldviews and methods that ultimately represent other classes, which in fact do prevent those who hold and apply these outlooks from first of all coming to an essential and essentially correct understanding of reality, and from actually transforming reality in accordance with the fundamental interests of the great majority of people in the world, and ultimately all of humanity. As with truth, reason, or the process of rational thought, will not by itself and in and of itself set us free. But we can never get free, never achieve the emancipation of humanity without reason and the process of rational thought, above all in the most comprehensive and systematic and thoroughly scientific sense. Now, this relates to the question of the two different kinds of leaps, once again, which were mentioned in that article that I wrote on two radically different kinds of leaps. The leap from the accumulation of experience through interacting with the reality, through engaging in practice of changing reality, the accumulation of perceptual knowledge, and then the leap to a higher synthesis, to an abstraction that concentrates more of reality, to conceptual or rational knowledge on the one hand, and on the other hand, a leap of faith, which is a leap away from reality and to conclusions or inferences which are in conflict with reality. Once again, I gave examples in the article of a trial, or for example, I will leave aside for now the example of football, and instead talk about the example of a small child being instructed in how to deal with traffic. If, you know, the child is instructed and led by an adult who explains to them the patterns of traffic, and they have a, you know, they're at the point where they're capable of grasping this, assuming that, and, you know, they engage in observation and instruction is given to them. At a certain point, they will themselves be able to make a leap to understand when it is safe and not safe to cross the street. That's a leap from perceptual to conceptual or rational knowledge, bringing together, identifying the patterns, bringing together the essential elements and concentrating them into a higher abstraction of reality. On the other hand, as I point out in that article, if someone were to tell the child, don't worry, you can go right in the middle of traffic. God will protect you. That is a leap of faith which is not only wrong, but as with many such leaps, will lead to disastrous consequences. One is representative of an embodiment, an expression of rational thought. The other is not. It is non-rational thought, and as I point out in discussing Michael Lerner's views in epistemology, it cannot help but lending itself to irrational thought. Now, speaking of rational thought, one element of this that's important, which, for example, Engels identified, even though I don't agree with all of the conclusions that were part of his identification of this, there is an important thing he identified, that one part of rational thought is what we could call formal logic. Now, for example, although when you get to higher levels of abstraction of matter, questions of time become more complex, within the realm in which we're dealing in everyday life, if something happens after something else, it can be reasonably determined that it the thing that happened after the other thing was not the cause of the first thing that happened before it. So I say when you get into theoretical physics, it gets more complicated, but fortunately for right now, we don't live in theoretical physics. We live in a realm of reality in which what I'm saying is true, because this is a more limited realm of reality. It's the everyday realm in which we normally deal with things. So formal logic is important in that sense, but formal logic has its limitations. And that's important to understand. In relation to this, and pointing to the limitations, Mao, in his Mao-esque way once again, pointed out with regard to syllogisms, which I'll get into in a second, that every affirmation in a syllogism is also a conclusion. And this shows a dialectical interconnection of things. What do I mean by that? Well, a syllogism is a kind of thing like this. Everybody in this room is brilliant. All the people in the second row are in this room. Therefore, all the people in the second row are brilliant. Well, that follows logically. You have an affirmation or a major premise followed by a secondary premise and then a conclusion. And it's all logically consistent. The question is, are the premises accurate and true? You have to step outside of the formal logic in order to be able to answer that. That was Mao's point about already in the first affirmation, there's a conclusion. The conclusion is that everybody in the room is brilliant. Well, where did that conclusion derive from? How did you arrive at that conclusion? You have to step back and analyze and determine by scientific methods that are much more all-encompassing than formal logic whether or not that first affirmation, which is also a conclusion, is a valid conclusion. How was it arrived at? Was it arrived at by scientific methods, and can it be verified and validated by scientific methods? Or take another example. Richard Pryor had this routine where he said, all Italians are not in the mafia, but most of them work for the mafia. Well, that's not true. But let's take the first premise. All Italians work for the mafia. Let's make that our premise. Giuseppe is Italian. Therefore, Giuseppe works for the mafia. Well, we'd have to determine, is the first affirmation, the first premise, true? Do all Italians actually work for the mafia? And second of all, is Giuseppe actually Italian? Before we could know whether the conclusion is valid. So not only the first affirmation, but even the second premise has to be tested in a larger context of engaging and drawing rational conclusions about reality. Formal logic can form a part of this, but in and of itself, it can't validly tell us what's true and not true. And this is an important thing to understand, that the what is valid and what are the limitations, if you put it that way, of formal logic. Nevertheless, formal logic is important. And we could go on endlessly having fun with these examples. All black people are good at basketball. James is black, therefore he's good at basketball. Well, we'd have to test whether the first two premises are true. Are all black people good at basketball? Well, in reality, it turns out, no. Is James black? I don't know. We have to go find out who James is and discover what his background and his relative national identity is. Nonetheless, despite its limitations, formal logic is important. In the context of and on the basis of an all-around and overall scientific approach, and once again, as this is most fully expressed, in proceeding on the basis of and with the method of dialectical materialism in a consistent and comprehensive way. Now, in contrast to this, let's talk about some more about faith. In the Bible, Paul, whom I've discussed earlier, says the following. Now, faith is the assurance of things hoped for, the conviction of things not seen. And we look not what at can be seen, but at what cannot be seen. For what can be seen is temporary, but what cannot be seen is eternal. And this is from Hebrews and 2 Corinthians in the New Testament of the Bible. Hebrews 11:1 and 2 Corinthians 4:18. Now what about this? This is very similar, frankly, to the reasoning of Karen Armstrong. Faith has its own standard of validity. Not that which science would establish, but the claim is that faith has its own standard of validity, and it's explicitly excluded from science because it's the conviction of what? Of things not seen, and things which not only are not seen, but cannot be seen by definition. And why is that important? Because as Paul goes on, what can be seen is temporary, of this world, in other words. But what cannot be seen is eternal. And this is obviously a tautology, just arguing in a circle. You've invented another realm which can't be tested and then declared that since it can't be tested, it's more important than that which can be. And this is why I say faith is by definition non-rational thought. It doesn't even necessarily involve consistent formal logic, but even more fundamentally than that, and even if there were religious expressions that did, the premises are not true. Can be shown by science to be not true, or can be shown to have no foundation which could even be, or basis which could even be tested to determine if they're true. And here we get to the whole question of burden of proof. You'll often hear religious people saying, well, you can't disprove the existence of God. Well, you can play that game forever. You can't disprove that you're not dead. You can't disprove that right now, sitting in this room, is an invisible dinosaur. If I declare by faith that there's a dinosaur in the room, can you disprove it? By definition, you cannot, because I'm not putting forward any attributes of this alleged dinosaur that are testable in the real world. So then we have to say, well, wait a minute here, motherfucker. The criteria and the approach is wrong here. If you posit something, it's up to you to supply the proof of it. We don't have the obligation to disprove the non-existence of things which do not exist. If you posit, if you argue for the existence of something, you are responsible for establishing that existence. And merely saying, I choose to believe it so as a matter of faith, does not make it anything other than a subjective notion on your part, which no one should have any reason to embrace or believe. If you cannot provide any reason, any evidence in the real world to cause them to believe it, and to say, well, I believe it, and it's true because it's important to me, is not evidence of its actual existence. It's only evidence of your psychological need. That we can establish. You have a psychological need to believe in this. But nothing beyond that has been established by your assertion that it exists because it makes you feel better to believe in it, or you know it as a matter of faith. That only tells us something about you, not about the existence of this thing. So, this substance of things unseen or not seen has no substance. This is not rational thought. This is non-rational thought, which inevitably verges into irrational thought and leads to irrational action. Action that is qualitatively and essentially out of line with reality, and therefore cannot lead to changing reality in any qualitative sense, and certainly not in the interest of the emancipation of humanity. So this leads us to the question then, well, about the role of religion. What harm does it do? A lot of people say, well, okay, maybe it's not true, but what harm does it do? It, you know, makes people feel better. A loved one dies, and they want to believe that they went to heaven, and when they die, they'll be reunited with them. Or something terrible happens in their life, and they want to take comfort and solace from the belief that there's some larger purpose directed by some God that makes this have meaning in some form. Well, let's go to Stevie Wonder for this one. When you believe in things and they don't exist and you suffer superstitions in your way. Actually, he said, you believe in things that you don't understand. But it's the same point. You do suffer when you believe in things that you not only don't understand, but you can't understand. And whether he meant it or not, this definitely applies to religion. Now, some might say, you're not Stevie Wonder. So who are you to say that it applies to religion? How can you say that? Well, it's simple and basic. I'm someone who sees very clearly that if you believe in things that you don't understand and you suffer, then superstition's in your way. And this is all the more true when you believe in things you don't understand and they don't even exist. And when you shape your life and determine your life, or try to, by belief in these things, you are going to suffer. You may seek some temporary, and even achieve, in a short-term sense, some temporary consolation. But you're going to be guided in going through life in a way that is fundamentally out of keeping with reality, to the degree that this influence guides how you act and how you see things. And the consolation will never be long-lasting, because life will keep asserting itself. And under a system like this, for the great majority of people in the world, it will continually bring forth horrors. And as we've emphasized before, what the masses of people need is not consolation for the horrors that they're continually subjected to. They need the means to put an end to those horrors so that that consolation is no longer necessary. And they cannot get that from religion. They can only get that from a scientific approach to reality. And the harm that religion does is it keeps them from getting that scientific understanding. And therefore from having any kind of thoroughgoing way the ability to bring about those changes, to join with others to overthrow and uproot the conditions that cause the suffering. Marx spoke of religion as the opiate of the people. Now he didn't do that in a simple-minded way. He said it's like a drug. He said it's the heart of a heartless world. This world of capitalism is heartless. It does treat people as things to be used and used up and then cast on the junk pile. Even little children. In the most horrific ways, we've talked about a lot of this. We need to keep on talking about it and bring to people the understanding not only that all this exists, but what it all flows from, and how it can all be uprooted and abolished. It is a heartless world, but we're never going to get a world with heart, to continue the metaphor, until we confront reality as it actually is, and on that basis develop the means for transforming it, and develop heart as part of that process, and more fully develop it as a result of that process. Also connected with this is the question of sin. This is a big part of the religions I've been talking about. Sin is a deviation from the way of God. This is a tremendous weight on the masses of people. The notion of shame and guilt that's associated with it, and more than that, the idea that whatever, you know, like I said earlier about disease, that things like disease are caused by sin or the demon possession. Something's wrong with that boy. The devil got in him. This keeps people from understanding and dealing with whatever is actually going on and what's wrong with individuals and with society. And as I pointed out in putting an end to sin in a part of Preaching from a Pulpit of Bones, there are two things involved here. One, there's no such thing as sin. Here's a syllogism, that formal logic that is true, because its premises are true. Sin is defined as deviating from the way of God. There is no God, therefore there is no sin. But there still is. That's objectively true, but what is also still objectively true is that there is the concept of sin, which weighs heavily on the masses of people. And what is the effect, and to a large degree the purpose, of promoting this notion of sin? It is that you, and generally the masses of oppressed people, are responsible for their own suffering. You must have done something wrong. You must have made God angry. You must have gone away from the right way instead of looking to the real causes. And if you don't look to the real causes, if you don't look to the real problem, how can you eliminate the real causes? How can you get rid of the real problem? If you think the problem resides in you, all you can do is be weighed down. It's adding insult to injury. It's an additional burden of oppression on people. Think how terrible it is to suffer every day as a result of the workings of this system, and then to have drilled into you that that's not why you're suffering, but you're suffering because of something wrong with you, in some way in which you did something wrong. Don't tell me that religion doesn't do any harm. It does tremendous harm. Now, tied in with religious notions is also the idea of human nature. Well, human nature is just this way. People are naturally sinful, or people are naturally selfish. It's just human nature to want to fuck over everybody else. These are not qualities that are some part of some sort of unchanging, quote-unquote, nature of human beings. These inclinations in people are a reflection and extension and expression of the production and social relations and the corresponding culture, as well as the form of political rule of a system that encourages and coerces people into acting in this way. People are thrown into competition and even into antagonism with each other all the time, both by the conscious policies and actions of the ruling class and by the underlying dynamics and workings of the system, as people have pointed out, even to get a job, even to have a means to live, you're thrown into antagonism with other people. And in The Poverty of Philosophy, a writing by Marx, he made an extremely important statement in this regard, in a very concentrated way. He said, "All history is nothing but the continuous transformation of human nature." And concentrated in that sentence is a tremendous amount of wisdom, if you will. Concentration of analysis of human society and of reality generally. That, once again, people enter in any given set of circumstances into relations with each other in order to meet the material requirements of life. Those production relations give rise in turn and are accompanied by certain social relations. Those social relations in turn give rise to and are accompanied by a certain superstructure, forms of political rule and institutions, and ways of thinking and culture which stem from and reinforce the underlying relations of production that people enter into and the corresponding social relations. And what seems natural in one era seems very unnatural in another. Marx made the statement about the future of communism that in that era, it will seem as ridiculous for one person to own one part of the globe as it now seems for one person to own another. But for the most of the history of humanity, it did not seem ridiculous and outrageous for one person to own another. Or for thousands of years, it did not. That seemed natural. And it was according to human nature that that would happen. It's how it was seen. Then when we moved to a point where the capitalist mode of production has largely taken hold, and wherever it is more or less thoroughly taken hold, one human being owning another and exploiting others as slaves is not in accord with the accumulation of profit by the capitalists. Capitalism needs a class to exploit that is not enslaved. Because of the motion of capital and the way in which different capitalists compete and proceed through competition to accumulate more wealth, there are times when it is in their interest to lay off a lot of workers. If you invest in a slave and have paid for the slave, and you don't get back your investment and some more, you've lost out. If you get rid of that slave before you've made back what you've invested, you've lost out on your investment. But if you're a capitalist, you don't pay in one lump sum to own somebody. You pay them by the hour, by the week, by the day, by the week, or whatever. And as soon as it's not profitable for you, you let them go. And you're not responsible for paying them anything else anymore. You haven't laid out an investment in advance to buy them, which you have to recoup by working them for a certain period of time. So it's not profitable for you, generally, under the capitalist mode of production, wherever it's more or less thoroughly taken hold, to buy and own people as slaves, have them literally be your property and exploit them in that way. It's more profitable to be able to hire them and let them go and have them be more mobile, free to move around and go from one capitalist to another. Therefore, according to the capitalist's human nature, slavery doesn't make sense and is contrary to what's good and right and natural. This is what an illustration of what Marx is talking about when he says all history is nothing but the continuous transformation of human nature. As human society develops and transforms from one mode of production and the corresponding social relations and superstructure to another, the notions of human nature and the character of how people think changes in accordance with that. That's why now slavery seems ridiculous and outrageous to people in a modern capitalist society, and why in the future, while now private individuals owning parcels of land seems perfectly natural and logical, it will seem ridiculous and absurd from the standpoint of communism. So there is no such thing, just as there is no such thing as sin, there is no such thing as unchanging human nature. Human beings do have certain qualities as a species, broadly defined, including the capacity for a high level of rational thought, of consciousness, of synthesizing concepts that distinguishes them as a species. But one of the things that most distinguishes them, including in their ability to think, is what you could call and has been called the plasticity of human beings. The ability of human beings to change with changing circumstances and to change their circumstances by consciously acting upon them. This is perhaps the most essential quality that distinguishes human beings from other species. So the notion of unchanging human nature is completely erroneous, and the idea that people are naturally selfish is, as Marx pointed out in the Communist Manifesto, nothing but a tautology, a circular argument. He pointed out that this amounts to nothing other than saying that with the bourgeois mode of production, people will think and act in according with the dictates of the bourgeois mode of production. And then you call it human nature to declare it unchanging and unchangeable. But we've seen from era to era, and even within the confines of the capitalist system, when there are upsurges in struggle, people undergo qualitative changes. Usually it's only temporary or partial, as long as you don't change the underlying material base of the society. But you see people going through great changes in their thinking. If that were not so, revolutions could never be made, and social relations could never be changed by people consciously reacting back upon them. But if you know anything about history and reality, it has happened all the time and will happen again in a wholly, radically different way. So this is the harm that these notions of religious notions and associated notions of sin and of unchanging human nature and the fallen nature of man and of humanity. It just all, you know, people, it all goes back to Adam and Eve. That's where all the trouble began. Eve convinced Adam to eat that apple. And that's why we're in the position we're in today. No. And the notion that that's so does a great deal of harm and keeps people from understanding why we're really in the position we're in today. So, on the one hand, we have to struggle vigorously against religion in all its forms, very determinedly, obviously, against the fundamentalist religious obscurantism and absolutism and its expression as politically as Christian fascism in the U.S. in particular, and its expression as the essential political equivalent, wherever that's the case, in large parts of the world today. And we have to struggle against religion as an outlook and approach to reality in general, because unless people cast that aside, unless and until they do so, not that most people are going to do it before the great leap to the seizure of power, but the more who do so before then and as part of moving toward that, the better off we're going to be. And then there's a whole struggle for people to do that over a whole period, a whole historical epic of transforming the four alls, of which that is a part. All revolutionizing all the ideas that correspond to these production and social relations. So on the one hand, we should not and must not underestimate the importance of the struggle in the realm of thinking, of ideology, specifically against the religious worldview in all its forms, because of the way in which it interferes with and leads people away from really understanding reality, and therefore being able to engage it and transform it to achieve their emancipation. At the same time, for a long time, including right now, it's going to be very necessary and crucial to unite with a broad diversity of forces, including many people who hold religious views of one kind and to one degree or another. The distinction can never be in terms of how we unite with people in the political struggle, whether they believe in religion or not, but whether they're willing to unite and can be one to unite in ways that are part of the struggle that is objectively in the interest of the masses of people. And to the degree they do so, we should be uniting with them, and we should be struggling with them to do so more fully and consistently, even while we struggle with them over the question of worldview. And don't simply put that to the side in the name of and supposedly in the pursuit of unity, and not undermining that unity. So we need a broad united front which will include many people who hold religious views. But at the same time, once again, we need the leadership of the proletariat and its ideology within this united front, or else it can never go where it needs to go. Can never thoroughly and consistently take on all these pillars of oppression weighing on the people, and it can certainly never lead to uprooting and transforming the whole thing. So the leadership of the proletariat, while seeking and working to unite as broadly as possible on a principle basis with many and diverse people and forces, including progressive religious ones, must also bring forward and be involved consistently, systematically, and vigorously in bringing forward the communist program, outlook, and method, and in particular, militantly bringing forward materialism, as well as dialectics, and specifically, as a key part of that, atheism. The understanding, not the opinion, the understanding that there is no God, and that all this supernatural stuff is not true and in the way of where we need, the belief in it is in the way of where we need to go. So while seeking and working to unite as broadly as possible on a principle basis with many diverse people and forces, including progressive religious ones, we also have to be consistently, systematically, and vigorously bringing forward the communist program, but not just the communist political program, but the communist outlook and methodology, militant materialism as well as dialectics, and specifically atheism, and fostering a spirit of active engagement and, yes, debate and struggle over these decisive questions. Not merely political questions, but epistemological questions of the theory of knowledge and generally philosophical and ideological questions. At the same time as we unite, there is a very real need and very important role for engagement and struggle among the people who can find common ground on which to unite in the political struggle. And in fact, in order to keep that unity moving forward and to give it an increasingly stronger foundation, there is a need for honest wrangling and, yes, confrontation of views in a principled way and from a lofty plane over fundamental questions of politics and ideology, including the basic issue of reform versus revolution, as well as fundamental questions of epistemology and philosophy, including such crucial questions as, what is the actual content, as well as the historical influence and effect of the major religions and religious traditions in the world, and where does following the teachings and traditions of those religions actually lead? What is the actual content of communism? And what is the essential nature of the experience of socialist countries ruled by the proletariat and led by its vanguard, the dictatorship of the proletariat? What lessons can and should be drawn from this? What is a correct understanding of what the ills of society are, what they stem from, and what is necessary to put an end to them and to bring a better society and world into being? What are the correct means and methods for understanding the development of human society, including in the realm of ideas as well as in terms of economic, social, and political relations and institutions, and the broader question of the nature of human beings and their relation to the rest of the universe, the rest of reality? What is the best way to understand, and what are the fullest implications of the principle that while meeting the basic material requirements of life for all of humanity is one of the bedrocks of a just society and world, this is not all that human beings need, that people cannot live by bread alone? And how do we understand the role of awe and wonder and the need to be amazed of human beings in relation to the material world and to the realm of ideas and philosophy? So in concluding then, let's pose the question. As opposed to being enslaved to things unseen, what would it really feel like and what would it mean to be free? Once again, we can encapsulate this in the four alls. The achievement of a whole new era in human history where we move beyond a world and the organization and coming together of humanity in a form in which there are antagonistic relations, in which there are class divisions in which some exploit and oppress others, and in which that's grounded in production relations that drive that forward and continually reproduce it, in which it gives rise to and is interwoven with social relations, such as those between men and women, which embody and continue thousands of years of tradition and reality of horrific oppression. And the transformation and revolutionizing of all the ideas and culture that go along with and reinforce that, to bring a whole new era of human beings into existence all over the world where we move beyond all that. So in tying together some of the key threads and underlying principles spoken to in this talk, let me quote from Preaching from a Pulpit of Bones and then move to a conclusion. As it says there, throughout the world historic revolutionary process that will replace the epic of bourgeois exploitation with that of communist emancipation, it will be necessary and important to unite all who can be united, including those who retain religious beliefs but are willing to fight together with or give support and assistance to the oppressed in rising up against the system that oppresses them, to unite with all those whose fundamental interests lie more with the oppressed masses and their revolutionary objectives than with the oppressors and the counter-revolutionary rule they seek to enforce. But while continually striving for such unity, and while respecting the right to religious belief and recognizing that the casting off of backward ideas must in the final analysis be the conscious and voluntary act of those who hold those ideas, it will also be necessary and decisive to struggle to establish the leading and guiding role of the one thoroughly scientific and thoroughly liberating ideology, communism. The communist revolution and the communist world it will bring into being will give flower and give flight to art and to the imagination, to the human spirit, on a far broader basis and a far higher level than ever before in human history. And it will remove the shackles of religion and all superstition. It will, in the words of the Internationale, free the spirit from its cell and allow it to soar to heights unseen and unimagined before. This is what it will mean to live in a world where it will be possible to give flight to the imagination without being caught up in the illusion that the imaginary is real. Where people will not go through life fearing the supposedly awesome power of supernatural beings which in fact do not exist. Where religion and superstition no longer stand in the way of consciously engaging and changing reality in the interests of humanity. Where there will be no need to search desperately for some other next life in which the endless night of suffering and anguish, mental as well as physical, will finally come to an end, because that suffering and anguish will have been ended in this world. This is what it will mean to be free in a far greater way than ever before in the history of humanity.